regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're through the program today. So we're going to talk with Knox Williams from the American Suppressor Association, but then Cloudflare decided to go kablooey this morning. Zoom wasn't working. Couldn't get Knox. I couldn't get my Zoom to work anyway. Maybe it was working for you. But we'll get Knox hopefully on the program later this week. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Congressman Andrew Clyde from Georgia. But today we're going to do a semi-deep dive into Wolford versus Lopez. This is the first case this term that the Supreme Court, the first Second Amendment case this term that the Supreme Court accepted. And on Monday we actually saw the first brief filed in Wolford versus Lopez. Oral arguments are scheduled for January 20th. Decision, you know, historically, the court has kind of kept Second Amendment cases until the closing days of their term. But this one, I don't know. I've got a feeling that this one could actually be one of the first cases that the Supreme Court releases next spring when they start to issuing opinions. And I could be wrong about this, but I just have a feeling that this one may not be 6-3, that we may actually see one or more of the liberal judges agree with the conservative wing of the court that Hawaii's default rule, which bans concealed carry on all private property open to the public unless the property owner expressly gives permission, that does not comport with the national tradition of gun ownership, nor does it comport with the text and history of the Second Amendment. But let's get into this. A brief filed by Alan Beck, Kevin O'Grady, and Mark Pinnock from a Maryland Shall Issue does a fantastic job of explaining not only why Hawaii's position is wrong, but why the Ninth Circuit got it wrong in upholding Hawaii's vampire rule. I like that phrase, vampire rule. I think Rob Romano from Farmers Policy Coalition coined that phrase, and it sums up so succinctly what this default rule is all about, right? Vampires could not walk onto private property historically, or at least mythologically speaking, without getting the permission of the property owner. You had to be invited in, right? Well, the same is true for concealed carry holders in Hawaii. You can't lawfully carry onto private property unless you're invited inside or onto that property by the property owner. This brief gets into first some of the arguments that Hawaii may use and has used to try to justify this law, including their attempt to say that this is not actually a state-imposed restriction at all, as it merely effectuates private landowners' decisions regarding guns on their property. As the plaintiffs point out, that argument was properly rejected by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Coons, which was a challenge to New Jersey's post-Bruin sensitive places, as well as the Second Circuit in Antonyuk, another post-Bruin challenge. And even the Ninth Circuit, which upheld Hawaii's default rule, rejected this particular argument. As the plaintiffs note, this law, quote, constitutes state action because it is government action that bars individuals on pain of criminal penalties enforced by the government from carrying firearms onto private property that is open to the public. Now, they go on to say, look, to be sure, a private property owner has the unquestioned right to exclude others, including those who are bearing arms. Petitioners, they say, have no quarrel with that principle. The right to exclude is one of the most treasured rights of property ownership. But that right, they say, belongs to the property owner, not the state of Hawaii. And they add that had Hawaii merely enacted a law that prohibited a knowing failure to obey a property owner's decision to exclude arms, they wouldn't have challenged that. They would have let that law stand. But instead, they say Hawaii has made it a crime to carry arms even where the owner of the property open to the public is merely silent. And that presumption tramples on the Second Amendment. As the plaintiffs note, only 5 states currently have a vampire rule in effect. Historically, that number has been 0. Maybe 1. I think maybe Alaska is the only state that had such a rule in place pre-Bruin. But the 4 other states that have the default rule in effect those were all responses to the Bruin decision. It was all anti-gun states saying, fine, if we can't limit who can carry, we're going to limit where they can carry as much as possible. So if we can't, you know, discriminate and say, you don't get to own a gun because we don't think you've got a good enough reason, we're going to tell everybody who gets a permit, you can't carry in places A through Z, including, by default, again, all private property that is open to the public. The plaintiff's attorneys say, in short, Hawaii's law is the same sort of broad prohibitionary regime that the court has already rejected, as it still makes most public places off limits, notwithstanding the general right to public carry. Hawaii's intent to eliminate the right to carry is both self-evident and illegitimate. Hawaii understood that the default rule would radically expand the private spaces where guns could not be carried. Such a rule reduces carry by making it increasingly inconvenient to do so. A default rule is sticky, they say. And when coupled with the 15 specific categories of locational bans imposed by the state of Hawaii, Hawaii's law prohibits, presumptively or outright, the carrying of a handgun on 96.4% of the publicly accessible land in Maui County. Now, it's just one county, but the numbers, I'm sure, are pretty similar across the state. 94.6% of publicly accessible land. As the plaintiffs say, the result has, quote, effectively nullified the Second Amendment rights of millions of Hawaiians to bear arms as they go about their daily lives in public. Legislation that restrictive of the exercise of the right to bear arms, they say, does not regulate arms bearing for a permissible reason. It, in fact, disarms law-abiding Hawaiians from public carry for no legitimate reason. As the plaintiffs write, Hawaii has eviscerated the Second Amendment right to carry for no reason other than Hawaii vehemently disagrees with Bruin. Indeed, in opposing the petition for certiorari, Hawaii asserted that its law is constitutional because Hawaii has limited the carrying of weapons in public spaces since at least 1852. As the plaintiffs note, Hawaii is thus claiming that the former Kingdom of Hawaii's traditions trump both the founding and our national traditions. That assertion cannot be accepted under the Supremacy Clause. Which is a really good point. You know, in that case, they cite Wilson. That was the case where the Hawaii Supreme Court justified all kinds of gun control restrictions, post-Bruin gun control restrictions, arguing that, you know, the Kingdom of Hawaii always had these traditions. It was the law of the paddle, I think it was. Just a weird, weird decision. But we're not talking about, when the Supreme Court talks about a tradition of gun ownership, they're not talking about a particular state's tradition of gun ownership, or even a region's tradition of gun ownership. Again, they are looking for a national tradition of gun ownership. What regulations are allowed under a national tradition of gun ownership? And that means you can't point to one or two laws from one or two states from, you know, one particular time period, particularly a time period that far postdates the ratification of the Second Amendment. A national tradition of firearms ownership, in my mind, should encompass laws that are substantially similar to the modern gun law in question, but also from a variety of states across the country. So in my mind, a national tradition of firearms ownership cannot be established if you're looking at, let's say, a 1794 law from Connecticut, a 1845 law from Massachusetts, and a 1832 law from New York. That doesn't establish a national tradition of gun ownership, right? You need to be able to point, again, in my mind, to laws that are substantially similar from Western states, from Southern states, from Midwestern states, from Northern states. And again, in my mind, it needs to be as close to 1791 as possible, which, admittedly, is going to exclude Western states, right? Because we didn't have any Western states in 1791. But even then, if you want to go to 1865, or 1868, the ratification of the 14th Amendment, you still have to be able to point to something more than just a couple of outlier statutes. And Hawaii can't. Their rationale for the default rule rests on two laws that the Ninth Circuit found were applicable. The first, as the plaintiffs write, is a 1865 law from Louisiana that made it unlawful for any person or persons to carry firearms on the premises or plantations of any citizen without the consent of the owner or proprietor. At the time, they say, premises or plantations would have been understood to refer to private land, not open to the public. Indeed, they say, Louisiana in 1865 expressly made it unlawful for anyone to, quote, enter upon any plantation without the permission of the owner or agent, whether they were armed or not. And a law controlling access to land barred to the public cannot serve as an analog for a law restricting access to property held open to the public. Full stop. It's absolutely right. They also note that the 1865 law in Louisiana was part of the Black Codes that were designed to deprive newly freed slaves of their civil rights. Which is another reason to discard Hawaii. I mean, not even just to discard Hawaii's intent to include this as an analog, but to, I would say, to chastise Hawaii for trying to use such a discriminatory law to justify this modern statute. But that leaves the 1771 New Jersey law as the only other analog for the default rule. And as the plaintiffs note, just like the 1865 Louisiana law, the 1771 law in New Jersey operated only on lands closed to the public. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals thought that this law was, quote, a dead ringer to Hawaii's default property ban, because it believed that it applied to all private property. The plaintiffs say that's not the case. They say that belief reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of how property law worked at the time. The statute only made it unlawful to, quote, carry any gun or on any lands not his own and for which the owner pays taxes or is in his lawful possession unless he hath license or permission in writing from the owner. Well, in New Jersey, in 1771, as the plaintiffs note, lands for which the owner pays taxes did not encompass all private lands. It meant only improved or enclosed lands. New Jersey at the time, they say, taxed only improved land. So let's say you've got a property owner. He's got, you know, 400 acres. He has cleared that land. He has plowed that land. He has planted crops on that land. He has built a house on that land. Okay, that's improved, right? But let's say he's got another parcel of 300 acres, adjacent or not, that is still in its wild state. In 1771, it would be illegal for somebody to carry a gun onto that land that contained the crops and the house where the trees had been felled. But it would have been perfectly legal for somebody who did not own that property to carry a firearm onto that parcel of land that still had the old growth forest, had not had any work done to improve that land, was not being utilized for agricultural purposes. Maybe even if the property owner was, you know, letting hogs run on that property, as they did back in the day, without any enclosed fences. It's still, without any improvement to that land would not have been taxed. And again, that land would not have been subject to the 1771 law. Unlike Hawaii's default property ban, doesn't matter if the property in question has been improved in any way. It doesn't matter if a commercial building has been set up on that land, if it's a domicile, or if it's just, you know, a couple of acres of volcanic rock. It doesn't matter if it's owned by a private property owner. You can't carry in Hawaii unless the property owner has said, yes, you can carry. So the hows and the whys of both of those analogs that were accepted by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals really don't apply to the modern statute in question. Now, the plaintiffs go on to make some other very salient arguments. They note, for instance, that sensitive places cannot be so broadly defined as to include all private property. They also note a quirk in Hawaii's vampire rule that the enumerated sensitive places in Hawaii contain a carve-out for adjacent parking lots. So if you're a concealed carry holder, you're going to the bank, for instance. You can park in the bank parking lot. You can lawfully leave your firearm stored in your vehicle. You can go and conduct your business. You're not breaking the law. But if you want to go to the restaurant across the street, that falls under the default rule. You can't. There is no exception for parking lots that are adjacent or a part of that property. You're hosed. You can't leave your gun in your vehicle. You can't carry the gun inside. And so, as the plaintiffs write, you are essentially forced to disarm yourself throughout the entirety of your day if you know that you're going onto any private property that's open to the public whatsoever. And that does deprive people of their right to keep arms. It doesn't regulate that right. As they say, it eviscerates that right to keep and bear arms. So it's a fantastic opening brief by the plaintiffs in Wolford versus Lopez. Hawaii Attorney General Ann Lopez has a December 17th deadline to file her reply. There may be one additional round of briefing by the plaintiffs before oral arguments take place on January the 20th, but I think things are shaping up nicely in Wolford versus Lopez, and I'm very confident that the Supreme Court is going to strike down Hawaii's vampire rule. I don't know how far-reaching this decision is going to be. I don't know if they're going to get into any language that could help undo some of the other sensitive places that we have seen around the country. But I think this is going to be the end of the vampire rule when the Supreme Court issues this decision of Wolford versus Lopez. I feel really confident about that. All right, before we get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, I need to bend down for just a second and grab this so I can talk to you about Modern Rugged Leather. I love this bag. This is fantastic. Modern Rugged Leather, you know, we've got Christmas coming up. Hanukkah's coming up. If you're looking for a good gift idea, or actually, if you're looking for something for you, you don't know what to ask for Christmas, might I suggest that you tell your loved ones about Modern Rugged Leather, modernrugged.com. There are all kinds of fantastic bags and gear. This is my new favorite laptop bag. I got to tell you, the construction is incredibly durable. I mean, you've got the riveted seams here. So much storage in this thing. And I mean, I hate to admit it, but I'm kind of a pack rat. I don't know that I'm actually going to be able to use all of the storage here, even as much as I love to shove papers and other stuff in my bag. But it is absolutely great. I've been using it for a couple of weeks. I actually had to go up to D.C. A couple of weeks ago and took this on its first road trip. It performed exceptionally well. Was able to store, you know, my laptop, my power cords, mouse. Mouse pad, a couple of other things that I bring with me when I'm traveling. And it did the job, man. I got to tell you, and it held up well. It still looks beautiful. I love the, it's modern rugged, and I love the rugged durability of this bag. So be sure to check out all of the offerings at modernrugged.com. Again, just in time for Christmas and Thanksgiving. There's some exceptional products, and I think you're going to like them as much as I do. All right, let's get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a case out of Denver, Colorado, where questions surround a Denver break-in suspect with a long history of prior arrests. Yeah, and the sad thing is we've got questions, legitimate questions. What we don't have are any answers about why this individual was out and about. 36-year-old Charlie Cooley is suspected of breaking into a home last month. Family ended up fighting him off. And as Fox 31 in Denver reports, some folks have been left wondering why he was back on the street after being arrested for a similar incident only a couple of months ago. Now, his criminal history goes back better part of a decade, a variety of different charges, but in particular, he was arrested in September in another home break-in case. Fox 31's legal analyst Christopher Decker says it's tricky to know exactly why he was back out on the street to commit the same crime again. He said people keep getting out because they either keep being given personal recognizant bonds or bonds that they can afford. He says that's the simple answer in cases like these, but digging deeper, he says, makes things a little less clear. One of the victims in this recent case said that he was informed by Denver police that Cooley had been released on bond within days after his arrest. Just days. DA's office in Denver cannot confirm that to Fox 31. Nor could they say what kind of bond he was given. Was it personal recognizance? Was he required to post any sort of bond at all? Was he placed on an electronic ankle monitor, which, as we well know, doesn't really work to monitor folks. It certainly doesn't stop them from violating the terms of their bond or release. Victim says a Denver PD officer told him that Cooley was wearing one, but again, that has not been officially confirmed. The legal analyst for Fox 31 says, you know, there were issues that should have blocked at least a personal recognizance bond. Cooley's history involves a felony robbery charge, violation of a court order as recently as September, but also a failure to appear in court charge last year. Now, if you were arrested for, again, robbery in September, then you're arrested again for robbery in November, and you've got a charge from a year ago where you didn't show up in court to answer previous criminal charges, why would a judge think that you are a good candidate to be released on bond to begin with? Much less whether it's a personal recognizance bond or whether you actually had to post amount some amount of money. He's got a history of not showing up in court after he's been told, hey, we'll let you out, but you show up. I mean, at that point, if you're still letting the guy out with the expectation that he's just going to show up when it comes time for a hearing or it comes time for his trial, you're an idiot. What makes you think that that's going to happen? Now, maybe this isn't a case of idiocy. Maybe, well, let me take that back. Maybe this isn't a case of individual idiocy. Maybe this is a case of institutional or legislative idiocy. And maybe this is the result of the soft-on-crime policies imposed by Colorado Democrats, even as they go after lawful gun owners. Speaking of lawful gun owners, let's talk about today's armed citizen story from Grand Prairie, Texas, where the Fort Worth Star-Telegram reports a resident fatally shot a suspected burglar in self-defense. This was Sunday morning, about 2 o'clock in the morning. Police got a call initially about a suspicious person. And then when they got there, they were informed by the homeowner that an unknown person had actually forcefully entered their home through the back door. The homeowner, described as an elderly man, was armed with what was described as a hunting rifle, confronted the burglary suspect, who was, quote, rummaging through property inside the house, and fearing for his life, shot the burglar who died at the scene. According to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, shooting to be investigated as self-defense. No charges are expected to be filed against the homeowner. The identity of the burglar has not been publicly released, pending notification of the next of kin. But again, police have already essentially ruled this a case of self-defense. They'll present their findings to the DA. He will most likely present the findings to a grand jury. But again, at this point, there's no reason to believe that any charges will be filed against the homeowner, who I would say reasonably believed that his life was in danger after somebody broke into his house at 2 o'clock in the morning. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. Some neighbors in Dothan, Alabama, who saved their elderly neighbor from a house fire. This was, I believe, Monday afternoon. Not only was the individual in question a seasoned citizen, but apparently disabled as well. And in fact, he was lying on the floor when he heard his alarm go off. Neighbors, I don't know if they heard the alarm, if they saw the smoke, but somehow they were aware that there was a problem inside the home. And several of them jumped into action, ran inside, carried him out of the house, saving him from the blaze, which, by the way, completely destroyed his home. One neighbor who spoke to WDHN said, I'm glad he's alive. He doesn't have any family, and I want to make sure that he's okay. Everybody involved wanted to remain unidentified. Nobody really wanted to give their name, which is fine. But in the right place, at the right time, we're able to do the right thing for a neighbor in need. And I'm sure that that care and concern is going to continue in the days to come. Those anonymous Good Samaritans there in Dothan, Alabama, we thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow, where, again, barring any internet implosions, our guest will be Congressman Andrew Clyde from Georgia, talking about the National Firearms Act. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com today. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. And if you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. No matter what tier of support you choose, you're going to get some outstanding benefits. And no matter what tier of support you choose, you will be supporting the independent pro-Second Amendment journalism that we're doing at Bearing Arms and here on Bearing Arms Gaming Company. So we thank you for that. I will say, if you become a VIP Gold or Platinum member, you get to take part in our weekly VIP live chats. It's happening every Wednesday, 1:30 Eastern. Hot Airs and Morrissey and myself get to hang out with our VIP friends for an hour. My favorite part of the work week. I'd love for you to be a part of it. And again, if you become a VIP Gold or Platinum member, you can. All right, have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.